Welcome to the MacGuffin Men.
This episode is brought to you by cocaine, because I know you want to feel like Robin Williams.
And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. Alex and James is here as well. Or I'm Alex. Not just saying names. yeah. So what's up, James?
I thought you didn't like talking about what's up. You got mad at me one time for asking.
That was sort of my lead-in, because you said you had an intro for this episode. Oh. Sort of like...
Okay. Well, I just wanted to open up by saying that this is going to be intentionally a multi-part podcast. Sometimes we talk too long and have to cut it into pieces.
Cause... Did you say sometimes? I think you mean most of the time.
Most of the time. But this one, we actually have... It's set up to be cut up in pieces like this.
We put thought into this one. Previous thought.
You're welcome.
They're going to be so let down when they hear what it's about.
Yeah, serious. This series, this trilogy of podcasts is all going to be about sports.
Yes.
We did do a sports podcast, kind of, with our Michael Jordan one.
Yep.
But this one is going to be very general about, I don't want to say all the sports, because I don't think we get to chess boxing. But most of the sports we're going to cover here.
I had some really good notes about chess boxing.
Throw them out. They're useless. This is kind of not going to be about every sport, but kind of the sports that are big in North America.
Yeah, I mean, like, I assume it'll be mostly the big four, like hockey, basketball, football, and baseball. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure soccer will come into play.
Soccer will
come into
play.
But that's more of an international thing.
Yeah, so we're going to be focusing on those sports. We're going to be looking at each one of them in every episode, but we're going to be looking at different elements of each one in every episode. So today's part one is more about sports as a game. So kind of the things that players and coaches think about during a game. Part two is going to be more about sports as a product. So more the business side of sports, the financial side, you know, advertising, TV deals, things like that. And then the third part is going to be more about sports as a cultural event. So we know that sports is pretty big. Pretty much all over the world, yeah. And kind of we're just going to be addressing why it's such a cultural phenomenon sometimes, why some people are super fans and miss their children's wedding for a football game, which will happen in part three.
I'm so excited to talk about sports fans.
Yeah. So right now, as I said, we'll start with part one, which really is very practical kind of sports stuff.
And just before we continue, just one quick note to all the non-sports fans out there. One, we're not going to be running these podcasts back to back to back. We'll put some time in between sports podcasts. But also, they're going to be kind of general, so you might even enjoy them, even if you don't care about sports.
Yeah, this really isn't a...
I'm not gonna list Larry Bird stats for you or anything like that, because I know you don't care.
I do have one Larry Bird-related stat, but it's interesting. And again, if you're kind of more into the pop culture media stuff... Part two and three definitely still would be up your alley, as it is that kind of stuff.
So, yeah, so let's get going.
Right on. I want to start with home court advantage.
Yes.
Which is something you hear about a lot, you know, when a game's coming up, especially in playoffs, that people really do put a lot of stock into. And I kind of always thought people made a bigger deal out of home court advantage than reality really holds up. But what do you think of home court advantage? Is it that important? Is it important as people say? Or is it just people looking for a story and something else to talk about in between series?
I think it changes depending on the sport. I think it's been pretty well proven that it doesn't really matter all that much in the hockey playoffs.
Okay, yep.
Just because you get so many upsets and so many just... I don't know. The hockey playoffs have sort of turned into the NCAA tournament, where if you get in the playoffs, you can win, you know, which has been sort of shown with like 8 seeds making the finals and stuff like that, you know, without ever having, you know, home ice advantage and always having to win on the road. Basketball, well, baseball, I guess I don't really know in baseball. I feel like it's probably, I don't know. Baseball's a tricky one. I feel like the biggest thing with baseball is like the length of the fence or how far back the fence is to... like how many basically home runs you can hit, you know, like if you're in Detroit or something, you're going to hit more home runs than if you're trying to hit over the Green Monster in Fenway, you know, NFL. I don't know. I think NFL and basketball, especially, it's very much sort of the home crowd trying to get the refs on their side.
Okay.
And I find especially in basketball, you get a big disparity when, between like even if we're just looking at the amount of fouls called on the home and away teams, the home teams, especially in the playoffs that just passed in the NBA, the home teams always got the whistles.
Okay. Yeah. So
any sort of questionable call will go the way of the home team, specifically because the refs are kind of terrified of fans, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, you touched on a couple good points there. Home court advantage really is a culmination of series of factors. It's not just, you know, playing in your home stadium, but even before you get to the game, you've got to travel there. So yep. If you are the Toronto Raptors and by some miracle you made it to the playoffs and you're playing the Dallas Mavericks, just traveling back and forth, the jet lag is going to mess with you, right?
Yeah, they would only play the Mavericks in the finals if in the playoffs. So,
so very,
you're very optimistic. I love what you're thinking about. What are you thinking though?
Yeah, I mean, just being on a bus or on a plane or something. That's just, you know, you don't get to stretch. The jet lag, as I said, all these things kind of throw off.
You're not at home with your wife and or kids.
Exactly, and staying in a hotel room instead of staying at home with your family. These kinds of things are just psychological and physical factors that are going to inevitably affect your play.
Yeah, it's like a business trip, essentially.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody hates business trips by the sounds of things. I've never been on one, but it seems like most people after a couple are kind of like, yeah, business trip, don't really want to go on it. And that's precisely what away games are for any athlete.
Yeah, do you know what a circadian rhythm is?
No idea.
Okay, it's kind of the sort of the internal rhythm that your body has, and when you're going through time changes a lot, it really messes up your circadian rhythm. So if you go on a really long road trip or something like that, mm-hmm. your body just kind of gets out of whack with its internal clock versus, you know, the world clock and all that kind of stuff. So yep. that's something that's always going to affect you when you're playing. Stadium design, especially in baseball, because in basketball, football, hockey, it's all very, very strictly regulated.
Yeah, yeah.
There are specific dimensions. I mean, in baseball, you do have 90 feet between bases and stuff like that, but the design of the park can change a lot. And, of course, the fans.
Yes. Yeah.
Affecting the referees, cheering on the players, and not even just the fans, but the staff at the stadiums itself. Whenever you watch, especially the playoff games, but even in the regular season games, what's the difference between the home team being announced and the away team being announced?
Cheers and boos, and, like, you get a big old four-minute unnecessary video or something
yeah,
for the home team.
Not even just the fan reactions, but the way that the announcer presents you.
Yeah.
He's not going to say bad things about your team, but it'll just be, Chris Bosh.
Yeah.
Dwayne Wade.
Yeah.
Ron James.
Other people.
Jamar DeRozan! And, you know, they just go nuts for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, psychological factors, that helps the crowd, but it also definitely helps the players, you know, feel more at home, feel comfortable, feel more confident and excited, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a big factor. It does change a lot sport by sport, as I said, not just the design of the field, but there are certain rules within each sport that make home court advantage more or less important than in other sports. Basketball to start, one very interesting fact that I found was in the playoffs in the NBA, the home team in deciding games won 78 out of 97 contests.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you at all?
No. I'm in that I watch or have seen pretty much every NBA playoff game in the last like 5 years. I mean, I've had those stats rammed down my throat so many times.
Yeah.
I just know them. And for the way that the fans seem to affect the refs more in basketball than in any other sport to me, I think that makes sense.
Okay.
Because, I mean, even if you're looking at like game 7 of the NBA Finals last year, the Celtics-Lakers, they were in L.A., close game pretty much the whole way. The Lakers just sort of pull it out despite Kobe shooting like 6 for 24. The Lakers in the fourth quarter shot 24 free throws, which is insane.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the Boston number is, but if it was half that, I'd be surprised. You know?
Like, yeah.
I mean, if they even shot 12, I'd be very surprised.
And speaking of free throws, in every game, when you're taking the free throws, when you're the away team, you've got all the fans behind the net going nuts while you're trying to, you know, yeah. concentrate on the single shot. It's really all pressure on you. And you've got people banging those sticks together, people waving. If you're LeBron, you've got people holding up signs about other players having sex with your mom.
Yes.
It's a tough gig when you're at the free throw line as an away player.
Yeah, true.
Do you know about what they used to say about the Boston Garden, the place where the Celtics used to play?
No.
Okay, they said that it was the only court that had these old parquet floors.
Yes.
And that there's all these defects in it. and that the Celtics always had an advantage playing at home because they were used to the defects and that they were knew where the bumps and the slants on the court were. And 85-86 Celtics with
Larry Bird.
Larry Bird, Indiana's new state bird. they played 40-1 at home, which is a record that still stands in the NBA.
Yep.
Some people say that it was had something to do with the court. Some people say it had something to do with Larry Bird being amazing.
But that team in general is like arguably the best basketball team ever in the NBA. So, I mean, they still dominated on the road too.
But that record stands.
Yeah.
Vanderbilt University. Do you ever see their college basketball games?
I'm sure I have.
Okay, so their home games, they kind of have a unique setup. When the court was built, it wasn't very unique, but as time passed, so many other courts kind of got remodeled and renovated that the Vanderbilt University, their court is the only one in the league they play in where the team benches are at the baselines instead of along the sidelines.
Oh, okay.
So your team bench is behind the net. Mm-hmm. So they say that the Vanderbilt teams, and especially the Vanderbilt coach, has an advantage because he's used to coaching from the bench, from the end lines like that, whereas other teams kind of have to readjust to it every time they get there.
Yeah, that would be really tricky for a coach, huh?
Yeah, you just don't see as much of the game, and if you're a coach who's used to seeing your plays from the side, you've got to readjust to seeing how they look from the end, too,
and,
right?
Well, and I'm the what I'm thinking is that for half the game, your team would be playing either. Well, I mean, for one half of the game, you'd have your defense playing like right next to you, and you could yell out instructions for them, like
like
funnel them into the lane, you know, take a charge or something like that. Like you, and your players could hear them. Meanwhile, on offense, they wouldn't be able to hear you at all because they'd be at the total opposite end of the court, and it would switch. At halftime, and that would be crazy. That would be really difficult.
And yeah, I mean, think about if, I don't know how many teams do this, but it seems logical to me that if you're playing in the normal setup where you have the team benches along the sidelines, say you put your head coach, you know, at one end so he can kind of control defense, and maybe if you want, you can put an assistant coach at the other end and still control the defense a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one, even if you split them up, you're still only controlling one half of the game, really, right?
Yeah. I don't even know how this Vanderbilt thing works. I'm very confused.
Yeah. Well, we can put up a little diagram if you want.
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, moving on to football now. I think someone asked you this question recently about the crowd noise at football games.
I do not remember being asked this question.
Maybe it wasn't you.
Lots of people want my opinions on things, Jim.
Anyway, I forget who it was. Someone just last year, maybe the Patriots. Or 2 years ago, received a little bit of guff for pumping crowd noise into the stadium.
Yeah. Indiana do this? Or, sorry, Indianapolis, the Colts, don't they do this all the time?
Yeah, I think that's what's weird about the story. Someone got called on it, and then it kind of came out that a lot of teams...
Oh, yeah.
Tons. And what's the process that they do here?
Basically, it's sort of... to make the crowd noise in their arena louder, they basically have sound speakers set up that just sort of pump in crowd noise, like fake crowd noise. It's like, it's the laugh track type. It's the laugh track for sports, basically.
Yeah.
It's like, Colts just got a big hit. They'll throw in an extra, oh, you know, like it'll just add an extra oomph. And I think this, you find this a lot in the NBA as well, in stadiums that don't fill up. Like, I think all of the New Jersey Nets crowd noise for the last 5 to 6 years has been generated by a speaker because nobody goes to those games. And I mean, this is pretty widespread at this point. It's kind of pathetic, but
yeah, it's a little sad.
It happens.
Yeah. Why is crowd noise particularly important in football, though?
To hear like play calls and audibles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because, so
I think it's the most, I mean, right. It does happen in basketball, but in football, it seems the most important, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Football's so detail oriented. And, that is a big reason that, home field helps in football, because I mean, if Peyton Manning's playing in Indianapolis and he asks the crowd to quiet down, they're going to do it because they care about Pepe. If he's doing it in Pittsburgh, they're probably going to boo or something like that.
Even louder, right?
And then none of his receivers will be able to hear him calling out like his now infamous audibles at the line of scrimmage. And I mean, you won't be able to call out, it will be harder to call out like hot routes, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, just change the play.
If Peyton Manning sees the defense line up a certain way and wants to change the way his team run their next play.
Yeah, and anytime you see sort of like a quarterback sort of sprinting over to a receiver and then yelling something really quickly and then sprinting back to under center, that's basically crowd noise. Like, the receiver just can't hear him.
Yeah, so, and also they can't hear the snap count, which means might be a little bit slower off the snap. And I mean, professional football, a quarter of a second can make the difference from, you know, an open player getting a touchdown to just an interception or something, right?
Yep.
So it can be very important. In high school football in the U.S., this is particularly important in down south where it's a lot hotter, but the home teams wear black jerseys.
Oh, yeah.
So this is kind of one of those instances where it's kind of a home court disadvantage because playing in your black jerseys, you're going to absorb more heat, maybe sweat more, more quickly.
It would be just dark jerseys, right?
Like, yeah, not necessarily black, but a navy blue or something dark.
That's the way most sports have swung now, actually. The home team typically wears the dark jersey. Which wasn't always the case. I don't remember what league started it. I think it might have been football. But, like, up until at least around 2000, the home team would be wearing, like, their white jersey typically.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know how that swung, but it did. I've always been interested in that and never had an answer.
And I know in some college football, the visiting team can wear their white jerseys only on their permission of the home team.
Okay.
So sometimes if they just want to be a dick or psych the other team out, they can say no. And there was one game between LSU and Georgia Tech where I think LSU was a huge underdog and refused to let Georgia Tech wear the white jerseys that they wanted and ended up beating them like 38-3. No one really knows why, and everyone is looking for an answer, and the coach said maybe it was the fact that we did this, but something worked out there.
Yeah.
Soccer can be a big one for home court advantage. It's really one of the sports that people point to as kind of the where you can get the biggest advantage from playing in your home stadium. It can be very important in international games like UEFA Champions League or even just the World Cup. As we were saying, the temperature can really change a lot depending on where you're playing, and that can affect, you know, just to go back to football for a second, when you're playing in Buffalo and you're playing in the snow and you're Tennessee and you rarely ever play in the snow.
I mean,
Oh, that's just a big advantage or a big disadvantage if you're Tennessee, right?
Or if you're playing in Denver and you're playing a mile up in the air, basically.
Yeah, Denver for pretty much every sport. So many of their, they're so high above ground. Their altitude is, they call it the Mile High City, right?
Yeah.
And that just affects the atmosphere. It affects how you breathe, which affects how you run and how you do pretty much everything.
I've always wondered why specifically the Denver Nuggets don't just sort of do like a total run and gun, like get their players so fit, just run all the time. And then by the fourth quarter, everybody's just totally tired out.
Yeah.
Because they just can't breathe anymore. Like, I don't know why. Like, if you get Mike D'Antoni coaching the Nuggets and with the team they've got now, I feel like they'd be pretty good. Even never playing defense, because they just wouldn't have to play fourth quarter defense.
Yeah, to go back to soccer, Bolivia, who is an okay team, not terrible, but not great, they have been known to beat Brazil and Argentina when they play at home because, like Denver, they're really high up. They're 3,600 meters altitude.
Okay.
And Brazil, I mean, usually ranked number one or two in the world. And Argentina is another great team. And In 2009, Bolivia beat Argentina 6-1, which was their worst loss since 1958. And again, Bolivia's not a like name.
What year was that?
2009.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Where was Lionel then?
Sorry, Messi. Probably in like elementary school. Yeah, the home court advantage or the home field advantage, I guess, in soccer can be very important in the World Cup, especially. There's so many teams that have won the World Cup who are hosting the World Cup, and it's not something that you see in, you know, other Olympic sports and stuff like that, but it's huge in soccer. Uruguay won in 1930 when they were hosting, Italy in 1934, England in 1966, Germany 1974, Argentina 1978, France in 1998, which sounds like a lot, and then you remember that these only get played every 4 years.
Yeah.
It's a pretty high percentage of home teams winning it all, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think the fact that the last home team to win was in 1998, and that there wasn't one for 20 years in between, I think sort of really speaks to how many fans can travel now to these games. I think that that number will only continue to decline, I think, like that percentage, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. It just really is easier for people to get around now and cheaper with...
Yeah, like basically the home field advantage by hosting the World Cup is diminishing, essentially.
Yeah, that's
just
true.
Just because it's easier to get there.
Yeah, and the thing is, with some teams, even when you can get there, and I'm thinking about English Premier League and some of the domestic leagues, because of soccer being known for its... fan violence.
Yes.
They like to separate the supporters and the crowd, right?
Yeah. But what I've always thought is a good idea.
Which makes tons of sense.
Any sport, not just because soccer has hooliganism and all that, but because I just like having it decided, you know, which side is which, you know?
Yeah, and then it just less fights break out. I mean, kids aren't getting exposed to people swearing at each other and people yelling at their dad because they're cheering for the wrong team and stuff like that.
Kids gotta learn.
Yeah, but I just mean everyone's happier when they're together with their other fans. It's like, you know, going to your friend's house when you're all fans of the same team and everyone's, you know, pulling for the same side.
Yeah.
It does make sense. But with the way that they separate the sections, even if it's two teams from London, the one team who's the home team will be given more seats. So that increases your home court advantage by having more of your players,
yeah,
amping up those psychological factors that we talked about.
Yep.
There was a study recently where someone watched, well, probably not watched all 5,000 games, but studied the results of 5,000 English Premier games and said that for every 10,000 additional people in the stands for the home team scores 0.1 more goals.
Okay.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And I suppose since it's soccer, that's kind of a number, you know.
Like it's a huge number in soccer.
Yeah.
When there's 0.5 goals in the average game.
Exactly.
The referees, as you were saying, could kind of get swayed by the large home crowds as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in that
sense, yeah, I guess that would happen in soccer as well too.
Yeah, and in the same study, they found out that more penalty kicks and favorable calls were given to the home team. Not shocking.
Yeah.
They said that is reduced when the ref has been in the league for more than like 15 years or something.
Okay.
Which I find really interesting that a new ref really does feel more pressure by the home crowd, you know?
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I think that makes sense. It's just, you care more about not wanting to screw up.
Yeah.
once you're sort of an established person and you've sort of seen everything, you're just like, oh yeah, whatever.
Yeah, you're more confident about it. And I mean, if you're really on the fence, if it's completely 50-50 and you hear tens of thousands of people yelling for one direction,
yeah,
that might just be that tiny little bit that sways it one way, and that can be enough. I mean, that will show up over 5,000 games of statistics.
And it's not like these are things that are thought of, like the ref has time to stand around and think about, you know?
Yeah.
For 90 to 95% of these calls, there is a split second to decide which way to, like, if you've blown the whistle, you have half a second to decide.
Yeah.
And if you've already blown that whistle, about 50% of the time, the call can only go one way. Like, it can only be a foul on this person or whatever, you know, if it's a soccer game and one person got fouled by somebody, half the time, you know, that person's on the ground and that's the only way you can really call that foul if you've blown the whistle.
It's
to call against the guy that's still standing.
Yeah, it's not like the goal's in or not. It's the whistle's blown, something's been done, someone's going to get punished for
exactly.
this. Yeah. We touched on it a bit, but baseball again. There's some of the rules in baseball give you home court advantage. So it's not just the crowd and like being in Denver and the atmosphere and the weather and things like that. But home team bats last.
Yep.
Which, I mean, everyone still has the same amount of time at bat, but just for, you know, sacrifice hits and, you know, sacrifice outs and really the strategy in the bottom of the ninth.
Yeah, exactly. It's just all about the bottom of the ninth for the most part.
You know, I mean, if you know you only need one run, you can get that one run and, you know, that's it.
Yep.
And since baseball is so unique that it's really one person at a time, it's such a turn-based game. I mean, other than cricket, but those kinds of games are so much different than hockey or soccer or basketball where the ball is, you know, it's a free-for-all, basically.
Yeah.
You really do get to control a lot in baseball.
Yeah, baseball's so interesting to me.
It's so unique. Like, the offensive team can't touch the ball with their hands and all those, like, weird things that just doesn't happen in other sports.
Yeah. Anytime I get, like, some sort of documentary or something about baseball, I will watch it in a heartbeat. But it's so... I don't care to watch baseball, the sport, typically.
Yeah.
But it's it's so interesting thinking about baseball and baseball strategy. It's crazy.
Yeah, there's so much going on. And that's kind of one of the things where, especially even 5 years ago, I could not sit through a baseball game. And through playing baseball video games, I've learned a lot more of the strategy and that kind of stuff. And watching baseball is easier for me now. I'm certainly not going to watch the 408 games that each team plays in a season of baseball, but
I think it's 508.
Sorry.
Yeah.
My notes are off.
Yeah.
For interleague play between the National League and American League, there's different rules in each league. So,
designated hitter in the
American League. So when an American team plays, when a National League team plays an American League team, which are awful names for a league, by the way. National versus American?
Yeah. Like, no, everybody's aware of this.
Okay, good.
Yeah. But C-League knows this. I mean,
but does nothing about it? But
yeah, that's kind of what he does. He knows about things and then does nothing about it. Like, he swept the steroid thing under the rug for so long, and it just, baseball never changes anything. Yeah. But C-League's an idiot.
Okay.
Let's continue.
Their thesis. Yeah, American leagues are kind of at a disadvantage when they play in National League parks because their pitchers have to hit, and pitchers just aren't used to hitting. And I remember having a bunch of baseball cards when I was young, and, you know, you'd buy a pack of, like, 10, and then there'd be one in the middle. And I remember there was one for the no-hitters club. So it was for pitchers who've never hit a ball in their entire career, which is a great honor to have.
Definitely.
The one thing that I really do like, and I guess this would have been Bud Selig's doing, is after the 2002 All-Star game when they tied, they made it so that whichever league wins the All-Star game gets the home field advantage in the World Series.
Yeah.
Do you like that?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I remember the controversy when Bud Selig called the game in extra innings. People were so pissed off.
Really? I barely remember that.
It was awesome.
How long did it go for before he called it?
I think it was probably like the 12th inning or something. It's not like it was exceptionally long, but I understand.
What's the problem?
If somebody gets injured playing extra innings in an All-Star game.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. I totally understand the reasoning for calling it. Right. It was just the controversy about it was really funny to me because it was a big deal. Yeah. And it was before non-stories are as big a deal as they are now. Like, that happened this year. It'd be insane. Yeah. Be LeBron all over it.
I really love that idea. I love the idea of an All-Star game or a Pro Bowl game actually having something on the line.
Yeah, for them absolutely. To play for. I completely agree. That's why, like, I love football. I don't give a shit about the Pro Bowl.
Yeah, no one really does.
The players don't. They don't.
When you're going to mention playing injury, like worrying about injuries, why no one cares about Pro Bowl because no one wants to go hard in the Pro Bowl because no one wants to ruin their career over a game that means nothing.
Right.
And I mean, if one side got home court advantage of it, yeah, it wouldn't mean that much, but at least there's something there that people are playing for.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and I mean, they couldn't do that in football because Super Bowl changes every year anyways.
Yeah. Next, I want to talk about heckling.
Cool.
Because I think heckling is awesome.
Should have brought old man for this one.
Yeah, really. It's
grade A heckler.
Again, that's something about improving my appreciation of baseball games.
Heckling.
Being there and listening to heckles.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
It's so awesome.
Yeah, what else are you going to do?
Drink. Oh, yeah. But yeah, it's so funny. And why is it more common in baseball? Just because you can actually hear them? Or is it just kind of like a tradition of the game?
You can hear them. Baseball is, I mean, there's just less constant action. I mean,
yeah.
It's the sport with the least constant action, you know? And you can get pretty close to a specific player. You can't get necessarily close to, you know, the center fielder and the first baseman. But,
yeah.
Or at the same time, I mean. But, you know.
Because, yeah, I mean, we're in speaking distance of that outfielder when we were there. Yeah. The last Jays game, right?
Yep.
It's not like hockey where they're constantly switching around and going up and down the. I mean, yeah. If the guys up there are just getting balls past them and not swinging at anything, they're just standing still for minutes at a time, and you can have a good dialogue with
and
them.
And it's not like there's constant crowd noise either, drowning you out. Like, if there's a hit, there's going to be cheering for a bit, and then you can wiki that player near you's mom and then yell stuff about his mom again. It's funny.
Maybe we should just mention Evan Longoria, who didn't even know what a bad name he had growing up until Eva Longoria got famous.
Yeah.
It was just too bad for him.
I mean, it's so easy that it's kind of lame.
Yeah. I'm sure he's over it.
Oh, he doesn't give a shit. He's playing in the major league. He's playing Major League Baseball. True. He does not care. His career will be longer than Eva Longoria's career.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Mm. One heckling story that I know you're a big fan of is Spike Lee.
Yes.
You want to just tell us a little bit about Spike Lee's heckling slash reverse heckling?
I assume we're talking about the Indiana Pacers one, right? Yeah. I feel like there's got to be more heckling.
No, not the time I went to the premiere of Do the Right Thing and heckled Spike Lee throughout the
How dare
entire
you.
Show.
You were a very, very gutsy two-year-old.
I was a very, very developed two-year-old. Yeah. Not only could I speak, I could heckle.
You shouldn't have thrown that garbage can, Spike. Yeah, so in the mid-90s, I forget exactly what year this would have been, but I mean, there was, for a couple years, there was a rivalry between the Indiana Pacers and the New York Knicks in the NBA. Spike Lee is possibly the world's most famous Knicks fan in that he's as famous for being a Knicks fan as he is for being a filmmaker at this point, I think, partially because of this. And there was, Spike Lee was doing a lot of trash talking when he was sitting courtside at the Knicks game with Reggie Miller, who was the best player on the Pacers in those years. And Reggie Miller proceeded to lead a pretty impressive comeback and score 25 points in a fourth quarter of a game, all while talking shit to Spike, basically, back and forth. And eventually the Pacers win the game, and there's one memorable moment where Reggie just looks right at Spike, grabs his throat like a choke, and then reaches down and grabs his nuts. And it's pretty funny. And I mean, that sort of continued in the series. Spike went to the next game in Indiana, and it was pretty intense.
to say the least.
Yeah. Indiana fans seemed pretty racist. Yeah, and, you know, I think the Knicks won that series, but the thing everybody sort of remembers from the series is Spike and Reggie Miller going back and forth.
Right on. Do you know the name Robert Ficker?
No.
Kind of a famous, well, infamous heckler, I should say.
Cool.
Yeah, it was it's funny because he was a Washington fan.
Wizards or?
Bullets.
Oh, okay. Or, well, now Wizards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. But yeah, NBA basketball fan. Who didn't like Chicago very much.
Okay.
Which is, and he gave Jordan a lot of guff at the time there.
Yeah.
Not knowing what eventually would happen between.
Yeah, fair enough.
Between, he didn't know Jordan would end up playing for Washington. I think he was actually died by that point. A little bummer. Okay. But he sat behind Chicago's bench when they would play in Washington, and I don't know why he got this idea, but he would loudly read passages from Phil Jackson's book, like really loudly, until Phil Jackson got security to escort him off the premises.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's really funny.
One of my favorite heckling stories, and this actually
is
moderately related to our podcast, and that it's kind of about movies. Matt Damon was at a Lakers-Celtics game, I think in the 2007 finals, the first time like Ray Allen and them played Kobe and them, the one that Boston won. And Matt Damon was sort of just not courtside, but he was pretty close, and he's jumping up and down yelling stuff. I'm pretty sure this is the game where the Celtics made that pretty impressive comeback. I think it would have been game four, probably. Anyway, Matt Damon's getting really excited, and Phil Jackson eventually gets tired, and he's like, hey, why don't you sit your ass down and shut the fuck up? And he yells at Matt Damon. And there are so many reasons to like Phil Jackson, and I love Matt Damon, you know, and Phil Jackson is still just sort of the most entertaining people that has ever been in the NBA.
He still wins that contest for you in that exchange.
I think he might. I think he might. Unless Matt Damon sort of ran up and pulled some porn shit on him and nobody told me.
No, that's a good start. One more Robert Ficker story I want to get out there.
Yes.
Charles Barkley.
Awesome. I'm excited.
When he was playing the Bulls in Chicago, he paid Robert Ficker to come out. He like bought him a plane ticket and his seat at the game, a seat behind Chicago's bench. And this was when Michael Jordan had some gambling allegations slash total truths going on about him. So Charles Barkley got
Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan are like best friends too.
Yeah. But they're both competitive people.
Yeah, no,
and would not let that get in the
way.
Yeah. So he got Robert Ficker, this heckler, to sit behind the Chicago bench. So he was pretty close. Like, it was a good seat, too.
Yeah.
He got Robert Ficker to bring giant cards and dice And he, like, Ficker would deal up hands for Jordan, ask him how much he wanted to bet and stuff like that. Just yelling at Jordan from behind the bench. And so he was ejected in the first quarter.
Oh my god.
For these shenanigans.
That is so funny.
That's funny, eh?
That's really funny.
Yeah. And makes me like Charles Barkley even more.
Yeah. Makes me like Robert Ficker way more than I ever thought I could. Because yeah, I didn't know who he was till 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, knowing who he is helps.
Yeah.
Do you know who the Cameron Crazies are?
No.
Okay, Duke?
Yes. University?
Yeah, very famous for their basketball program.
Yep.
So their fans are known as the Cameron Crazies, and they're a little bit crazy, we'll say.
Oh, really?
They get into it. There's really good footage on YouTube. We can put up a couple clips, but they like to just reach their hands out, like, almost as far to the court as they can and, like, shake their fingers and just be like, at opposing players and stuff like that. They like to do their own, I guess, commentary from the sidelines. So when the other team has a ball and they're dribbling up and passing up the court, they go, boing, 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 pass, whenever the other team does something. They like to get, when the other team gets a foul and then that player gets a ball again, they just say, you, over and over and just do a bunch of crazy stuff to remind them that they have a foul, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. It's, I guess, just to throw them off. Again, that psychological factor. When one of Maryland's players came to play at Duke, his name was Herman Veal.
Okay.
But he was kind of under investigation for sexual assault. So some fans brought a sign that said, did you buy her flowers after? Things like that. University of Duke didn't really like this. I mean, they liked the enthusiasm, but not so much this.
Yeah.
So the Cameron Crazies kind of got reprimanded. They started making threats about, you know, not letting fans show up and stuff like this. So the next game, they wanted to be very, very calm and polite and stuff like that. So they held up signs that said, welcome fellow scholars. They're insulting sexual assault signs.
That's funny.
As we talked about before, when there's the free throws like that, everyone behind the net tries to throw them off or hold up signs or make noises.
Yep.
They held up signs that said, please miss, which is good.
Nice.
And when there's a call that went against them that they didn't agree with the ref's call, they chanted, we beg to differ, we beg to differ.
That's really funny.
Yeah, some of the crazier fans, I guess, are going to show up in parts three about cultural phenomenon.
Okay.
When you're kind of the super fanatics. We'll get into that.
Yep.
But I want to talk about one more heckler.
I'm fine with this.
Yeah. Another baseball heckler, Robert Zaz.
Okay.
Ringing any bells?
Is he related to the character, I think, Edward Zsasz in Batman Begins?
I don't believe he is. But I'll look that up after.
Yeah.
We'll verify that.
Yeah, I bet you will.
He's kind of just a really infamous heckler. He's got, like, his own YouTube channel and stuff. And
okay.
People seem to know him. But he really has been good at getting under players' skin and really messing with them. Mm-hmm. A lot of players know him by name and hate going to the stadium because they know he's going to be there. His thing is, he calls himself the happy heckler. He never swears or makes personal jokes about people, about their weight or their height or their race or their family or anything like that. Just really, you know, nice, well-spirited insults, I guess. Yeah. But again, I don't know how he does it, but he is really good at getting under their skin. Jose Guillen, I'm probably mispronouncing that.
I think it's probably Guillen.
Guillen.
Yeah.
Jose Guillen offered him an autographed bat if he would just stop heckling him for a game. Like, I don't know what this guy does, but he really messes with people.
That's awesome.
He approached them and offered him an autographed bat, but it's kind of like, you're Jose Guillen. I don't know you.
Yeah.
Why do I care? And Brett Boone, another guy, there's good footage of this too, but he throws down his bat and helmet and just goes right up to the stands and just starts yelling at the guy, like, so viciously. So I don't know what he does, but he's doing something properly.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about referees, because I know it's something that you have particular interest in.
They direct everything, you know, like, sometimes unfortunate how much of a hand they have to play. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I know we've had this talk a little bit before, but where does that pressure come from when you say that refs are making a call one way or the other? And does it vary sport to sport? Do you think that some leagues are kind of more, I guess, hands-on about getting the refs to call games a certain way? Or is it kind of just more the superstar calls that we talk about where, you know, the league wants one player to be really good, so they let LeBron travel or something like that.
The league does let LeBron travel.
Yes, that's been established.
But like 4 steps. Jordan got 3 steps. LeBron gets 4. It's insane. I don't know, because the only one I really think about the refereeing a lot, outside of like pass interference calls in the NFL, the only sport I really think about refereeing a lot is the NBA, which is, I mean, most basketball fans will agree that there is at least some form of state-sponsored cheating going on in the NBA continually. In that, the referees in basketball will get sort of a heads up early in the day as to what they should be looking for, especially between games in playoff series. Like, say they called game 1 really tight, or game 1 of the finals really tight, and there were a lot of like ticky-tack fouls, like little slap on the wrist type of thing. Or something that I noticed in this year's playoffs, there was a game against between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Dallas Mavericks, where Kevin Durant was doing his patented sort of rip-through move, where he sort of holds the ball low with 2 hands and waits for a defender to try and put their hand out and just sort of have their hand there. And then Kevin Durant sort of swings the ball up so that his arms basically hit the defender's hand. And then he just sort of chucks the ball at the rim. And this normally ends up in him getting 3 free throws. And this happened three times in one game. It might've been like game 3 or 4. And then in the next game, Kevin Durant tried it and 3 different times and didn't get the call once. And I mean, it's pretty hard to argue anything other than the league said, don't call this swing through move this game, you know, like, right. Or the referee just deciding, I'm not going to give you that. And that's my big issue with the NBA is that there is no consistency in calls. There's no consistency between games. Very often there's not any consistency during a game. And let's say there was a way to go back and replay the past 20 years of NBA history, you know, like sort of simulate it with a, you know, totally like a robot calling the game. And this robot is always correct, always objectively correct. NBA history is much different. I don't know how, but it's totally different. I think specifically the Celtics win game 7 last year. I think, the Kings beat the Lakers, in 2002 or 2003, whichever one had that famous series that the Kings clearly got jobbed. I mean, just tons of things would be totally different. And I mean, who knows, maybe the Kings or Lakers jobbed an earlier team and that round would have been someone different. It would have been like the Nuggets or something. But yeah, I think the NBA is, I don't know, I hate it, but I love it. I hate that I like basketball so much that I put
what
up
with that
this.
Corrupt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know how the World Cup refs get chosen to do their games?
No idea.
Okay, so it was pretty interesting because it was funny. There was one Canadian basically employed in the whole World Cup last year, and it was one linesman.
Okay.
And there was no Canadian players, obviously, no Canadian refs, just one linesman. And kind of what they do is they hook up a team of one ref and 2 linesmen, and those 3 are always going to work together throughout the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll write for a qualifying game, and if, you know, if FIFA says they didn't do a good job, they might not ref again for the entire tournament. They might take a game or two off. And as you said, just like in the NBA, between games, they say, look, you weren't calling this. You were missing these kinds of calls. You were being too strict about this kind of thing. Do you think that would make sense for a lot of other leagues to have refs kind of work on kind of a basis? Like, you know, if you're not going to call these things properly, you're going to be out of work for a week or a month. Or do you think that's unfair to the refs?
No, I don't think it's unfair to the refs. I recognize the referees have a very hard job, but if they're fucking up, you're ruining my sport. You know?
Yeah, and I do want to say that. I mean, refereeing is a tough job.
Unquestionably.
Yeah, it's very hard to make...
Especially when you have to listen to the directives coming down from the league about how to call a game.
But, I mean, yeah, snap decisions and things like that. But that leads into one other thing that I want to ask you, and that was, how do you feel about the use of video replay in sports as it is now? Do you think we could
I'm all for it.
In, like, just in every case?
Pretty much anything. I wish pass interference calls could be overturned in video in the NFL. I recognize it ruins the flow of the game, and there are tons of times when
video replay is used when it shouldn't be, just because the call is so clear, the refs just missed it. And yeah. I mean, that's when it slows down the momentum of the game. If you're fixing something, that's awesome. If it's something that was, say, a ball goes out of bounds and everybody knows it was off a specific player, and the refs just made a bad call and are checking it, or they made the right call and are checking it anyways.
Yeah.
Like, we all know it's right. Let's move on. You're killing the flow. But if the difference is a blown call or waiting 5 minutes, yeah. even if it's a blown call going against my team, you know, like, let's get it right.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel about these ideas? I mean, you hear it in soccer a little bit, but, and it's still pretty kind of speculative, but the idea of putting a chip or something actually in the puck or the ball or something like that to see when it crosses the line, when it goes to the hoop, when it goes out of bounds, things like that. What do you think about that?
I'm fine with it. I don't think I'm alone here. I would want very rigorous testing before it's ever put into actual play.
Definitely.
And then, I mean, even when you do start using it, use it in preseason 1 year and then fix whatever problems you had in preseason and then maybe next year implement it full time. But that would be tricky. It would be a really big undertaking for any given league. I think soccer, that seems like the one it would help the least. Like, because soccer is very sort of loosey-goosey with the out-of-bounds and stuff like that. And very rarely is there a ball questionable over whether or not it went over the goal line, correct?
Yeah, there has been some recently where I can think of one where somebody hits the crossbar, it bounces down, and in the replay you can so clearly see it goes over the line, mm-hmm. but the backspin makes it come backwards, hit the crossbar again, and then the goalie stops it. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like it hits the crossbar, hits the ground, hits the crossbar. You know, logic makes it seem like, yeah, that probably didn't go in. It hit the crossbar, bounced directly down, bounced directly up, mm-hmm. and then the goalie snapped it up. But in the replay, you can see it so clearly that it's in.
Huh.
So there is that use for it.
Did they get the call right?
No.
Okay.
They didn't count it a goal. I think it was little Stevie Gerrard, too, if I remember correctly.
That sounds like such a textbook Stevie Gerrard goal.
To wrap this one up, I just want to move on to the end of the season, the playoffs.
Okay.
And sort of the different formats between, I mean, the different playoff formats between sports.
Okay.
Right off the bat, do you think that there's anything that you, in kind of in any sport, that you think really should be changed, or something that you really don't like in sports?
The BCS in college football.
Yeah, that's kind of the big one. So that's the bowl championship.
I think
series.
Literally every fan is on my side in this one. Yeah.
The and what's the problem with the BCS?
It's all very much dependent on a variety of factors of how you play the throughout the season, like who you beat, who you don't beat, and stuff like that. And then it sort of just generates which championship you should be playing for. And I mean, there's a national championship, but there's always debate as to whether or not the two actually best teams got in,
yeah,
because of the way it's decided. And I mean, it just makes the most sense to have a playoff of some sort, you know?
Yeah.
Like, how does this not make sense? How does it not make sense for the NCAA as far as money goes?
Yeah.
It's totally baffling.
Yeah. I mean, Barack Obama has come out and said that he's not a fan of the BCS setup. I mean, if the president is saying it's not a good idea.
Everything that guy says about sports is correct, pretty much. Like, I'm so impressed by him.
Yeah, so
as a sports fan.
Yeah, so the BCS, just, there's computers, there's lobbying, there's ballots. And as you said, sometimes the teams who make it to the finals aren't necessarily the best teams, and it depends so much on who you beat. And not just who you beat, but who that team beats throughout the year.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's been cases of some teams winning all 10 games but not making it to the finals, because how they do it is they weight the people you play, give you a certain number of points based on how many people they beat, which is weighted against how many people they beat and how good they all were and things like that. So you could literally do everything, win every game, and still not come up as a champion.
Just because you didn't have a hard enough schedule or something.
Which isn't your fault at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I know you've said before you're not really a big fan of the way the English Premier League does it, and a lot of the soccer leagues do it.
I always want a playoff, you know?
Yeah, because what they do is whoever has the most wins at the end of the regular season
wins.
Yeah.
The points.
Yeah. The one thing I do like about those leagues is it's not like where we have kind of a, say, a farm team or the minor leagues or the D League in basketball. You have, you know, the Barclays Premiership League, and then you have the Coca-Cola League, and then you have a series of promotions and relegations. So if you're in a second tier league and you get first or second, you get promoted to, you know, the show, the top, yeah. you know, the biggest league there is. And then if you lose the second tier league or your first or second last, you move down to the bottom one. So it's a series of promotions and relegations. So that way, even the teams who are, you know, in the last three positions, when they play each other near the end of the season, it's still exciting because they're really playing for a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's what I really like about that. But the fact that there is no playoffs, I think you're right, really does take away a lot. I mean, it's just more games, more excitement, more of the top teams playing each other,
yeah.
develops more rivalries. It just makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I wanted to ask you was the Super Bowl. Do you think that should just be one game?
Yes.
Why? But you seem to like everything else being a best of seven kind of thing. Is it just the nature of football because it's such a short season?
Part of it is the violent nature of the game and the fact that, I mean, by the looks of things, you just can't play it more than once a week.
Yeah, having a best of seven could potentially add half of a season.
No, exactly.
to your game football season. Or right?
A season of 16 games, is it not? So, yeah, it's literally almost half a season.
Almost half a season.
The argument is, I mean, anything would be more exciting in a one game playoff. Anything. Because Game 7 is always the most exciting game of any given series if it gets there.
Of course.
So it's always going to be more exciting to do a one game playoff. And it was, and like, if you take away money and all that stuff, I think I don't know. But I think the most exciting playoffs would always be a one game playoff. In basketball as well, I don't want it to happen because I just like this sort of seven game format in basketball.
Just to have more things to watch.
Yeah, basically
ends up having. Do you think that makes the better team always win? Are you worried about a one?
It certainly it helps. It absolutely helps. Like say the Grizzlies Spurs series this year, when the Grizzlies won game one. I mean, it was kind of a close game, but the Grizzlies sort of won it decidedly. And I was like, did they just get lucky? And then game two, the Spurs won, but it was clear the Grizzlies did not just get lucky. And then the best team ended up winning that series, which is the Grizzlies. And I think it really removes some questions about stuff like that.
Yeah.
It can sort of cover up a terribly called game, because the team can sort of come back the next game. I think it really does help the best team move on. As far as excitement, it does not really improve anything. And I mean, a game seven is more exciting than a one-off playoff game because you've got six games of sort of bad blood going into this, and
that's true.
It just adds more to it. But I think in any situation, a one-game playoff is more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it is always cool when an underdog can manage to do it in one game, which is what's cool about things like March Madness or about Super Bowl playoffs, where you really, if you can get that together for one game, you can beat, you know, anybody.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's the thing. Like, to win the Super Bowl, you need to go on a 4-game winning streak.
Yeah,
essentially. Which is,
if you can, and sometimes people get into the Super Bowl, I mean, into the playoffs without even a winning record, or just a winning record.
Right, and I mean, you can win the Super Bowl winning 3 games in a row if you get a bye week and don't have to play in the wild card. Okay. But I mean, what you're seeing, especially in football, let's say in the last decade, you've gotten a lot of teams that have sort of, they've had to play in the wild card weekend and they've gone on to either play in the Super Bowl or win the Super Bowl. Like Green Bay played in wild card weekend. They won, this year's Super Bowl. And I would bet probably half the teams that have won the Super Bowl in the last 10 years or so have probably played in wild card weekend.
I love wild card weekend.
Yeah, no, it's great. Just because, I mean, there's the argument that it sort of keeps them sharp. They don't get the week off.
Yeah.
Then they just get to keep working through their problems, and then they sort of figure them out at the right time and just happen to win 4 games. And you're getting these adjustments, or you're getting an extra week where you get to put in these adjustments, and you're sort of figuring out new things about yourself that you can then use on your next game and stuff like that. And it just sort of escalates, and then people just keep seeing new things, and they just can't stop it because they haven't seen it midseason, because you were like a mediocre team all season.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, you got the Packers, the Giants when they beat the Pats in 07. Got to be something else I'm just not thinking of. I think Pittsburgh did it when they beat Arizona. I think they played in wild card.
I think that had more to do with Troy Polamalu's hair than anything.
I think that had a lot to do with a lot of really impressive plays. That was a really good Super Bowl. Well,
agree to disagree.
Okay.
Anything else you got to say about sports?
No.
Cool.
Well, I mean, I've got two more parts, but
but not about this one.
No.
Awesome. If you have anything that you want us to cover in any other podcasts, any topics you'd like to see us discuss.
Or things we missed in this, or future parts of the sports conversations that we will be having. Feel free to email us at themacguffinmen@gmail.com.
Well, stay tuned for parts 2 and 3, which will be coming up in a little while.
Yeah.
But we'll have some more movie-related stuff coming up next week.
Yep. So thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men.
This episode has been brought to you by Cocaine, because I know you want to feel like Robin Williams.
Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.